Thursday, December 14th, I returned to the land where I was born and raised. I had an early call from Dale Meeks about 6:30. There was a front with thunderstorms and low ceilings moving through toward East Texas. We could not fly. I accepted it, but reluctantly, called my agent to meet me in the kitchen, dressed and went downstairs and had coffee. There followed an hour and a half of uncertainty. I asked my agent to find out how long it would take to drive to East Texas. About 6 hours. I could see he took a very dim view of this. But only when I was about to lose it did I realize how much I had looked forward to this visit. Dale phoned and re-phoned the weather. And then, somehow or another, I don't quite remember how, Lyndon got in on it. I think he called me to see what I was doing. And so, of course, he took over. He talked to the weather in Washington, to his military office, came back with a clear directive that it would be safe, a lot safer than 6 hours on the highway, for us to fly. We could land in Shreveport. Dale said he'd agreed all along that it was perfectly safe, just turbulence, and he knew I didn't like that. I think I must make him nervous. And so, a little past nine, Dorothy and I were airborne. It was a foggy, dismal trip, but quite uneventful and smooth enough to satisfy me. And we sat down in Shreveport a little after 10:30. There were cameras and reporters at the foot of the steps. I answered questions briefly. I was coming on a private trip to see old friends in Karnak and Marshall, paused in front of the car for a picture, and then was off down a wide, monotonous, absolutely unfamiliar highway. No landmarks. I might as well have been in Iowa. Until, going the long way around, we arrived at Marshall and then headed for Karnak. We reached Doris's home about 11:30. There was a little group to meet us. Doris and Hugh and Corinne Barnes, the regional man from the post office, Mr. Myers with his wife, another post office official, and Jim Roberts, who, pro bono publico, had drawn the very attractive plan for the Karnak post office, and Don Hine, who had done the landscaping plan, also free. To thank them was one of the main reasons I wanted to come. Mm-hmm. Doris had coffee and refreshments spread on the dining room table. We milled around a little uncertainly, and this is where I began to miss Liz. This trip needed an advance man, so I attempted to take over. I suggested to Doris that we go on down to the post office and see it, and then could we come back to her house, bringing the principals, Robert Hine, Myers, Dixie Odom, Clarence Faison, if we could get him, and who else? Anybody who was a leader in the community. Anybody who would put a shoulder to the wheel to help get the grounds of the post office planted. For this was the real purpose of the trip. Doris said, I know, we'll call Colonel Larned from the plant. Then we divided up into several cars and drove down to the post office. It was everything I'd hoped. Soft, pinky beige brick from Daddy's store. Later, Doris and Clarence both said they could remember when it was built, from 1909 to 1911. A colonial design with a little porch, columns and trim in reddish brown, and a cedar-shake roof. It really had some style. Now, if we could just get it landscaped. It was, regrettably, a very tiny lot, and they'd had to put the parking right in front of it because of the necessity for safety on the Monsanto Highway. Jam up to one side was a red-striped washer terrier. We went in. There was Dixie Odom and a small group of Karnak citizens, postal employees. All of them greeted me by, hello, Lady Bird. And some of them, do you remember me? There was Clarence's daughter, Jeanette Faison, who had tragically lost her husband just a few weeks ago. So young, in her 30s, I think. We had fruitcake and coffee. I looked at the interior. There was picture taking, but no press. And then, still missing Liz, I tried to gather us up and take us back to Doris's. Colonel Larney joined us, a barrel-chested, jovial, professional military man. And then Clarence Faison came in from his mail route, and feeling both unequal to the occasion and determined to get the show on the road, I appointed myself chairman of the action committee. First, our object was to get the post office grounds planted. Second, a disclaimer addressed to Mr. Myers and to the room in general that I expected the federal government to put in 1 cent more to plant the grounds of the Karnak post office than they would for any other comparable one. Third, and oft repeated all day, an earnest thank you to Mr. Roberts and Mr. Hine for their talents and skills put into this little building that would hopefully set a new tone for this community and would be something we could all be proud of. Next, how to get the money and to go to work. I brought out the plan that Mr. Hine had drawn. He spread out his larger one, and I pointed out that it estimated the job would cost $1,875 even if we reduced the size of the trees. Now, I would put up a $1,000 from our little family foundation if the community was interested and would try to raise enough to complete and maintain a good planting job. Mr. Meyer spoke up and said that the federal government paid $250 for landscaping of a post office this size, and Dar said that the Karnak Improvement Association had about $200 in its treasury. And about that time, Mr. Hines said, well, they could reduce the size of the estimate by taking out some of the ground cover. We were beginning to approach the goal, especially when Mr. Meyer said that maintenance was no problem. They did that on a contract basis with the postmistress, federal government paying the bill, a maintenance man hired locally. And then two good things happened. Doris came back in the room with a big smile. She just talked to Virgie, treasurer of the Karnak Improvement Association. They could put in $500. And then the colonel spoke up and said, now some of these trees I see on this plan, sweet gums, we have plenty of those trees on the reservation. And I think I could furnish a truck and a winch and maybe some labor. Hugh and Clarence began to speak up in unison. Oh yes, they knew where there would be some fine sweet gums. And how about those dogwoods down next to the old so-and-so place? It began to be quite delightful. Mm-hmm. Clarence and Hugh offered to go into the woods for some of Colonel Larned's labor, find the sweet gums and dogwoods. I appointed them naturalists for the enterprise. And Mr. Don Hines said he would come down from Dallas and spend the day with them, finding the just right trees. Fresh from my experiences in our own pasture, I thought they would find many a tree that was just not the right shape or that they couldn't dig. But it certainly could save an enormous lot above nursery-raised trees purchased 150 miles away and hauled to the site. So I thought this was a real breakthrough. I told Mr. Hine that I liked his plan very much. It was so truly indigenous. Sweet gums that would make a lovely October color. The dogwoods that would be a drift of white in spring. But I thought we ought to have a magnolia, so we substituted one in front of the red and white striped Washeteria as a screen. And we thought about maybe another evergreen in the back. A live oak, a water oak, instead of one of the sweet gums. Early in the conversation, Doris had taken me aside and said, now what do you think we can do about lunch? I had no plans. Alas, she had called me several days earlier because Diane had wanted to entertain me in her home. But though I had tried, I had never connected with her on returning the call. It turned out just as I would hope. Doris and Hugh suggested taking us all for a catfish lunch on Caddo Lake. So just as the meeting was about to reach its end, Doris asked for a show of hands on everyone that would like to join us for lunch on the banks of Caddo. Everyone would. 13. And so, with plans pretty well wrapped up, that we had $1,750 to go on, plus some donations of trees and labor, and more of the skilled help of Mr. Don Hine. But I'm sure some big gaps as to who is actually in charge and what the timetable is. We adjourned our meeting, and just as we were going out the door, there were two young girl reporters from the Marshall News Messenger and a photographer, he from the Shreveport paper, I believe. And for the rest of the day, they followed our every step. We went down to Big Pine, and I showed Dorothy Torito the gray, sluggish, cypress-lined big bow along which the steamboats used to ply, shrouded in mist today. And then we had a big, delicious catfish lunch. It was late, and we were all starved. We emerged with the flash of the cameras. And with Dorothy Torito and Doris, I drove out to the brick house. We'd phoned, and Ruth was waiting for us, looking quite well and very pleased to see us. We sat in the high-ceiling living room, quite soulless now, without the fires burning merrily, I remember from winter days of long ago. She's done the whole house over, mostly in pastel colors, modern furniture, unremarkable except for the one magnificent bedroom suite that would have done honor to Scarlett O'Hara's bedroom. I longed to know if the fireplaces would still work behind those facades, if the old random-width floors of pine still remained below these modern hardwood floors. I did not ask, but I did ask if we could take Dorothy Torito around to see the house, and we did, and I gave little vignettes all along the way. This is the banister I used to slide down. I love this view from the front porch. This is where we used to sit on summer evenings, Daddy in his rocking chair. This is the room where Aunt Effie and I slept. I always liked to see the fire making shadows on the wall after we went to bed at night. And this, the dining room, is where I remember my last great Christmas morning when Mother was still alive. And I described it in detail. As we walked through, I saw very few things to remind me of Mother. A big clock in a mahogany case, two chests elaborately carved. For blankets they were, I think. The two rockers that I remember Daddy sitting in all the days of his life. And finally, a small, graceful mahogany tea table. And this I would so have loved to ask Ruth for a wedding present for Linda. I couldn't quite. We drove on to the Marshall National Bank, picked up Mr. Vivian Hackney, and then went to the old county courthouse. I have some wonderful pictures of Lyndon campaigning for the Senate here in 1941. And also of his opponent, Gerald Mann. And also the successful candidate, Pappy O'Daniel. This was one of my main destinations of the trip. We wanted to see the Harrison County Historical Museum. For nearly an hour and a half, we wandered through it. First, a collection of Indian artifacts from the Caddo Indians. Extensive and fairly sophisticated, many of them donated by Kelly Arnold, who gave me the very first artifact I ever owned. Then, the Lady Bird Taylor Johnson exhibit. And it is done in excellent taste, I think. The red satin dress I had sent them is displayed in a large cabinet on a very nice mannequin. And there's a stylized painting of the brick house with me as a little girl of about 6 out in front of it, done by some Texas artist from an old snapshot. Winston had donated both the snapshot and the money for the painting. How like him. And he had never told me about it. I was amazed at the wealth of material they had, and they've only been in existence 2 years. The tiny satin slippers of Southern Belles of the 1850s. Marshall is an old, old town. And the small waist and delicate lace of a pink taffeta gown belonging to Lucy Holcomb, Marshall's most glamorous lady of those days. The original papers of Governor Ed Clark of Texas, who had taken over the governorship when Sam Houston was locked out of his office for refusing to take Texas into the Confederacy. The lady guide told me there were no duplicates of these personal papers, and I could see Dorothy Torito getting the shivers. And Marshall had been, for a short period, the capital of the state of Missouri, believe it or not, during the tumultuous times of the Civil War. And there was a lot of memorabilia about that. It was Mirabeau, Bonaparte, Lamar's sword. I was amazed at how many of the old names I remembered. Star and Key and Pierce. It was really a journey into yesterday. And right in the middle of it, of course, inevitably, someone appeared in front of me and said, "Do you remember me, Claudia?" Alas, I didn't. And I wondered if she would have remembered me. Nothing at all had identified me. There was one delicious moment when I came upon the candy case from Daddy's store, and I saluted that get up and get for having saved it from some junk pile. I took a few minutes out to hear 6 local men, including Mr. Richard Blaylock, tell me about an urban renewal project Marshall was planning. And then, just as I was going out, who should I run into but Bill Moyer's mother, beaming and telling me they were all coming home for Christmas. We embraced each other, and I told her that I thought it had been a great exhibit about Bill, a big case of memorabilia, especially magazine covers on which his face appeared, and the title, Our Man in Washington. At the door, there were a cluster of folks, black and white. I shook hands, greeted everybody, told them how nice it was to be back. And then we were on our way to the last and much looked forward to event of the day, a cocktail party at Philip and Murdy's. Finally, after 16 or more years of marriage, they moved into a house of their own, and a charming one it turned out to be. Murdy and Philip and all their 4 children, dressed up and looking adorable, were on hand to meet us. And a group of my old friends gathered together on about 24-hour notice, perhaps 50 or 60 people during the course of the next 2 hours. It was wonderful. I made the circle of the living room, family room, and den, and then began cornering friends for a quiet talk on the sofa. Tommy Solomon, with whom I used to have dates in the University of Texas, and a philosophic, mellow, interesting person I think he's become. He and his nice wife told me about their large number of children, and Harold Solomon and his wife, and Sarah Taylor from Jefferson, Tommy's wife, who told me Susan was going to school, and she felt doing much better, and Ruth Lester, full of news of the museum in Jefferson, Franklin Jones and his wife, our frequent political enemies and sometimes friends, especially when we're down and out, which we must be now, because he told me, "You really didn't think we had to worry. Where have those liberals got to go? The Republicans will nominate Nixon or Reagan or worse, and then they'll all have to come home to Lyndon." Doris and Hugh and Velma and Diane, looking very sleek and stylish, and telling me about the Marshall Symphony, and Dudley wanting to know about Lucy, It was all such fun, and so easily the gulf of 30-odd years, with most of them, was bridged. Georgia and Russell Lassinger, who own a small East Texas newspaper close by, were there.
And Russell,
looking like a genial gnome, was going click, click, click with his camera, while I, with a mouthful of ham or cheese, looked like a chipmunk. I was reaching for my glass. I was exclaiming over a friend I hadn't seen since Marshall High School days in 28. Finally, I said, "Russell, let's just get all the good pictures you want, and then let's us both come to the party." The Hackneys were there briefly, because he was MC at the Marshall National Bank party that night. And there were faces dimly remembered, are bright and clear. I kept on telling Dorothy Dorito that the Scotts or the Baldwins are so-and-so, used to know my mother and daddy before I was born, or when I was 3 or 4, or in high school. Finally, about 7:30, I made my goodbyes. We drove to the Shreveport Airport, and at every entrance or exit all day, there were the Marshall newspaper reporters, two young girls. I'd told their boss, Mr. Woody, that they'd done a good job, and he had told me that he felt sure he could deliver Harrison County for Lyndon. We flew to Austin. The weather for the last 30 minutes worsened and was increasingly bumpy. Dorothy was quite worried, but I was encased in a cotton wool of satisfaction and pleasant memories. I reached Lucy's and Pat's about 10 o'clock. It's wonderful to have a place to lay my head here in Austin. Took a look at Patrick in Slumberland and went happily to sleep in that comfortable and pleasant guest room.